Hello, fellow homebrewers. JP here, and I want to introduce to you the brand new Brewbuilt X1 Conical Series available at More Beer. More Beer sells the highest standard in homebrewing equipment, and the Brewbuilt Conicals are just that. They're made from mirror-polished 304 stainless steel, and they come with loads of features that you and I have been looking for. They have a full 2-inch bottom dump valve, which will eliminate your clogging issues, while the sturdy base includes 4 reinforced legs, just like those big pro tanks do. More Beer also carries the Brewbuilt line of options and add-ons like casters, pressure kits, and even external glycol chillers. So you can find out more about the new Brewbuilt X1 conical uni tanks by going over to morebeer.com for detailed videos on the entire line of Brewbuilt conicals. You can trust Brewbuilt with your next fermentation, and you can trust More Beer to find the right conical for you. Brewbuilt at morebeer.com.
Everybody, welcome to the session, my second one this week, which is exciting for me.
Working harder than you think you want to there,
yeah,
Justin.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes you have so many good guests lined up, you just got to do it. And now that we don't worry as much about being live, per se, we do still go live. You're watching us on Facebook right now. Hi there. But we actually, because we can accommodate people's schedule more, we just get people who are like, yep, I can do this day. And I'm going, cool, I'm here. We had Ghost Town on just on Monday.
Oh, they're so good these days.
Brewery of the year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great guys, too.
Really nice people. Talked about their new brew house, which was a fiasco putting in. They put it... I shouldn't spoiler alert. I just put it the podcast out there. But essentially, they put in their brand new brew house, went to fire it up, and there was a major issue. And their solution... to put back the old one that they had just taken out. But there's more to that story. So tune into that one that I just put out there and you can check it out. All right. Today we have Nate Smith back on the Brewing Network with us. Welcome, Nate.
Hi, guys. It's been a while. It's awesome to be here in the Hop Grenade once again. It's been a minute.
It has. I'm really glad you could make it. I gave Nate a call. We've been talking about trying to hammer down a date, so I'm really glad we could finally do that.
Yeah. You couldn't find a real guest, so now everybody gets to talk homebrew with me, which is super.
Well, what's funny,
which is super cool, and we're kind of like back to the roots here for a second, which I think is awesome, and
I think it's what people will like.
Yeah, it was one of the things that got me into the show before I was ever on the show. I was a listener, and we talked homebrew so much in those early days. So I think this will be exciting.
It's going to be all homebrew today, except for the beer we're drinking. We'll talk a little bit of pro beer in that sense. And then we've got Vito DeLucci hanging out with us, too.
DeLucci. Hey, what's up, guys?
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. Stoked to be here.
Vito's the perfect guest because of our topic today, which I promise you, I didn't choose the topic. I just approved it, even though our topic today is brewing the perfect pale ale. And Nate, I don't know if you've succeeded yet, but I know that you've gone on this quest to brew the perfect pale ale.
Yeah, I think it's one of those lifelong quests which you'll never really... Right. Completely nail if you're a brewer, even a home brewer or a commercial brewer, if you like the style, any style that's your favorite.
Sure.
Pale ale. Hoppy pale ale is one of my absolute favorite styles.
Yeah.
And one that if I'm home brewing often, and certainly was for the reason I'm about to describe, that's a beer I'm going to want on tap at home at any given time. Something between maybe 4.5 to 5.5, maybe pushing up to almost 6 if you're feeling like making a slightly stronger one, but something kind of sessionable that's super hoppy, but not necessarily up in the 6 to 6.5 or more IPA kind of range, but like big hop impact, nice and dry, nice and drinkable. Like for me, it's something I want to sit and like play guitar for 2 hours and drink 2 of them or something.
Right.
You know, like,
and still feel fine.
And still, yeah, so maybe go do something else. But at the beginning of the pandemic, when, you know, we all didn't know it, but in mid-March 2020, all of a sudden, we're injected into this new world that we don't understand. I found myself really wanting to fill some of those gaps with homebrewing, and that's when I started on this reinvigorating this idea of really trying to nail the perfect pale ale, and starting from all the ideas and notes that I'd had from doing that for years, but encountering different things along the way with what I think is how ingredients have changed over time and kind of what our common wisdom is about the style.
Sure.
And our perception of what we think a good hoppy beer is. Some of that has still continued to change. Like Vinny used to talk years ago on the show about that lupulin threshold shift.
Yeah.
Not necessarily just in terms of hop bitterness, which is kind of what the joke was at the time, but our perception of what a good hoppy beer should taste like.
Sure.
Whether it's a pale ale or an IPA. I think that's become a little more elusive to nail on the homebrewing side than maybe it was years ago.
I think so, and it's so broad now too. I'm sure we're going to talk about ingredients and new hops and things like that. Yeah. But yeah, I've had some single hop pale ales, right? That, some of them I can take them or leave them, but others are fantastic. We're going to get into a little bit of that. But like as an example, I had an all Nelson pale ale.
Yeah.
And it's hard to even call that a pale ale, but at the same time, it was delicious. It was dry. It had all the characteristics of a pale ale, but also was a ton of diesel and dank, but it was still only 5.5%, right? Yeah. So there's a lot to talk about there, and I'm sure we're going to dive into all of it. Before we do, I want to thank our sponsor, still with us after all these years. I should write them a song. More Beer. You can go to morebeer.com and check them out. And Vito actually helps out with a lot of the things I've been promoting lately. For example, I always talk about Free Beer Friday. Vito makes some appearances on there. You should go check out Free Beer Friday on their YouTube page every Friday and win some cool stuff that Chris Graham's always giving away. Vito also has a podcast and a video series that he's put on YouTube that's doing very well, where you go talk to pro brewers sometimes. You've gone and talked to other homebrew shops.
Yeah, we call it the mashup. So it's just, kind of talking to pro brewers, talking to homebrew shops. Yeah, just stoked to have More Beer, gave me that platform to talk beer and homebrewing, and beer industry stuff too. Like we went to, bottle shops, things like that, just all kind of across the board. So yeah, really cool. Check out the mashup on YouTube.
Check it out on their YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/, is it More Flavor or More Beer?
On the YouTube channel. On YouTube / More Beer.
There you go. Check it all out over there. And thanks to More Beer for supporting us. A couple other things to announce real quick. Tickets are now on sale for the 12th annual Spring Brews Festival. Happening here in Concord, it's on March 25th this year, the last Saturday in March, as always. Rain or shine, we'll be doing it. There'll be probably 60 breweries there like we usually have. It's already shaping up to be a really exciting lineup.
Homebrew booth as well?
Homebrew booth as well. I already talked to the Doze boys to do Tasty's Tasting Room.
Tasty's Tasting Room lives on.
It'll be back.
Immortalizes the
awesome. Good. I talked to Lee. We're going to brew Janet's Brown for it.
Oh, perfect.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Homebrew.
Janet's Homebrew, Brown. Of course. Yes. Oh, that's great. Yeah, so check it out. You get all of Tasty's Tasting Room plus 60 breweries plus live music. Just signed a Eagles cover band that is killer. Like, 6 pieces.
Oh, wow.
They do all the harmonies. I was like, man, you guys are pretty dope.
6 piece. You'll fill that stage out there. That's cool.
So we got them. I haven't secured the other band yet, but it's looking to be good. So just go to thebrewingnetwork.com, click on the events page, and you'll see it right there. You can get your tickets. Get them early because they're cheaper now, and they go up probably in March. They go up as soon as this tier sells out. So don't be a procrastinator. Okay. And then finally, just support all of our sponsors. That's a great way to help us out. For example, Beersmith, the Beersmith Brewing Software. You can go to beersmith.com. He's on version 3 by now. You get a free trial of it. It's fantastic brewing software. Pro brewers use it. Home brewers use it. And he's been a great sponsor of ours for years and years, since we were at the Rat Pad. So say hi to Brad over there, Brad Smith, who created the Beersmith Brewing Software. And finally, if you want to talk to us, just send your feedback to feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com. Happy to hear from you, and sometimes we even read it on the air. All right. So Nate already told us how he got started on this quest. Pandemic hits, stuck at home, decides he's to brew more, and chooses pale ale as his muse.
So I figured he'd be doing this for maybe 2 months, maybe three months,
right,
something
yeah.
like that.
Say 3 weeks, right?
Yeah. Knock out a pale ale every week or every couple of weeks and have something at home to enjoy and drink and kind of kill the time, but no.
Yes.
Sure enough, 18 months flow by, or the better part of 12 to 18 months flow by, and I homebrew about 20, 24 times, and
How many of those are pale? Is it 20, 22 pales?
About 50% of that is pale. Okay, so like 12 out of the 24 were pale ales in that 12-month period. So
yeah.
That was something that I wanted at all times. It was interesting to have a control or something else that wasn't pale ale, not only just to enjoy that, to have something to drink, but kind of as a check on the process, because not only did I also want to have a hoppy beer on tap at all times, but I started running into unexpected issues in producing one just to have to enjoy to drink at home. You know, nice 4.5-5% sort of beer was the original target, like something I could knock out and brew pretty easily, but kind of go crazy on the hop side, stay fairly simple on the malt side, keep the yeast fairly constant for the pale ale variation, do a dry yeast like USO5 or a liquid yeast like WLPO, White Labs 001 or Y Yeast 1056. I used all those kind of interchangeably a little bit as I was trying to perfect this and mess around with it. But those, I brewed three other beers as a beer just to have around to drink, also a couple of other low alcohol beers in the mix there too. A session 60 shilling.
Okay.
And a session American Stout, just to have something to mix it up.
Nice.
And it was nice to have that as my original idea was I would take and harvest the yeast from those, because I was brewing often enough. I was really into this idea, like Jamil talked about years ago, billion cells per milliliter or per degree Plato. Let's really keep a healthy yeast strain around.
Yeah.
If I have enough time to brew often enough, let's just keep that flowing. So I'd start that yeast oftentimes with this other non-hoppy beer.
Wow.
And then kind of burn that yeast out through repitching on the hoppy stuff, not wanting to repitch something that maybe had seen a dry hop, for example. So
how are you capturing that yeast? Did you have a conical that you're just dumping out the bottom?
More beer conical. Yeah. Some of it mixed up the fermentation vessels too. Sometimes did got 12.5 gallon more beer conical, which I've had for way too long now, and it's still kicking. It has the temp control element in it and everything, you know. It's from 20-25 years ago, but brewed into that, and then would harvest off the bottom if I was pulling yeast from that, or even kind of wanted to split batches further and do different temp control experiments from time to time. So also brewed into good standard 5-gallon carboys. And like Jamil talked about years ago, you can still harvest yeast off of those if you're careful about it. And you can flame the lip of the carboy and stuff like that, and just kind of, you know, really carefully, gently into Nalgene containers like we've talked about in the BN ever since the late 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, harvest your yeast into that and kind of let it settle out and then decide how you want to pitch off of that. But that can got me into trouble, I think, at times too, because your viability and your pitch rate from repitching is a pretty tough thing to do on the homebrew level and keep that consistent.
I mean, okay.
Unless you're going to actually go to the level where you have a
methylene blue and
Exactly. Yeah. What were you going to say about that, Vito? How would somebody normally want to, if they were going to try and do that at home, they would need like simple lab equipment.
Yeah,
and
simple lab methylene blue. I think you like break it down 5 times. You need to take that yeast, water, cut it, then put it under a microscope, get a little clicker, and you're basically just looking for what cells metabolized the methylene blue and count them, you know, and then there's an equation, I don't know it off the top of my head.
See which ones are alive versus dead,
so
basically.
Then, and then you say that's X amount viable because of, you know, they metabolized that,
An interesting control for the way in which I thought I was starting to get in trouble with that, and I thought I was probably over pitching, and I'll get into why in a while, but batch splitting with 10 or 15 gallons and then pitch dry yeast on one of the variants, and just to see what would happen. And we've mentioned this before over the years, and I think it's worth saying again that the quality of dry yeast is really good.
Yeah.
And it's better than people remember years ago, and you can almost kind of pick any supplier. It doesn't matter, in my experience, if you trust the shop you're getting it from and that they're treating it well. Like Morbier does a great job, which is where I was getting all this stuff.
Okay.
It's funny, during the pandemic too, it like call in my order, and I was going to the San Leandro location, like you'd go there and they had a table near the door. Total pandemic style delivery stuff.
Curbside pickup or whatever.
Those guys knew me really quickly because I was going there all the time. I was brewing every week or every other week, and they'd have all the stuff ready or whatever. You couldn't go in there and browse or whatnot. But anyway, you trust your good local homebrew shop, especially, you know, the people there, and get stuff like dry yeast, and it's in really good shape, I'd say.
To that point, dry yeast is amazing. I keep referring to it as like a dry yeast revolution, because not only is there better strains, but the labs that are producing them, you know, like Lallemand and Cellar Science, the equipment is, you know, top notch, high end. It's not like, I think, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years, there was like bread manufacturing yeast company. We're like kind of turning that out. So it was, you know, not as good. So I think it got a bad rap. and know, I at think least when I started.
And deserved.
Deservedly you know, yeah. so, yeah. But now it's gotten a lot better. And,
sure.
And then, you know, doing some reading about that too, like the way they harvest it. So it's an aerobic fermentation. So the lipid levels are way higher in the cell walls. So you don't need to aerate your yeast, which to me was like, I'm getting ahead of ourselves.
No,
yeah,
not
yeah,
at all. Yeah. That's great. I think it was that's like, exactly.
I was
some
like,
of this
no
reason.
Way. But then like reading some of these, information out there is like, okay, you know, that's, and I've done it and it's like, yeah, that actually works with dry yeast.
Yeah.
You can kind of depend on your viability.
And the viability is just way better per gram, more cell count and viability than you'd get with liquid.
Right.
For sure.
I think in terms of trying to, this idea, the quest of trying to brew the perfect pale ale, and I was real, the parts I was struggling with, I thought were probably on the fermentation side. The things I thought that I wanted to really dial in over time, having dry yeast was really important as a control in that sense, because with the modern production methods like you talked about, Vito, I think you can depend on everything you're getting out of that packet to be more or less viable and good, or at least within a really pretty tight margin versus what maybe you would expect years ago. So your pitch rate from the dry yeast may be way more predictable than what you're trying to repitch if you're just repitching,
sure.
Which is what the other thing I wanted to experiment with, just because I think that's how you learn good brewing batch-to-batch practice that you could translate for either commercial brewing or just your own knowledge.
Yeah.
Trying to develop skills around repitching, but counterbalance that with this idea of like dry yeast or something where you can really depend on your pitch rate.
Yeah, I love that you use it as a control
I think that works really well for that. So encourage everyone to think about that as an idea, even if they don't want to use it for everything. Use it as a way to sort of A-B your experiments. And I think that as I was trying to keep things like dry hopping constant, but mess around with how I would treat the yeast a little bit differently, that was a really cool way to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Because you can, especially if you take like WLP 001, White Labs 001, or US 05, you can treat them fairly similar on the fermentation temperature side too, then, if you want to keep that as a constant in the experiment.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what were you're mentioning some of these flaws that you were running into. Do you want to dive into what that was?
Exactly.
That you were trying to...
So one of the pale ales that I was brewing, I kept the malt bill fairly simple. Like I would do mostly a 50-50, maybe two different types of two-row, something like a Viking pale and rar two-row or rar two-row, and even up to 50% Pilsner malt, sometimes blending in up to maybe 15%, something like Maris Otter, keeping the malt side fairly simple. I looked at my early, of the 12 or so that I brewed, I looked back at my early logs, and like the first two or three had a little bit of crystal malt for fun. I deleted that pretty quickly.
Okay.
Just to keep, all I wanted was using like 2 or 3% just for color.
Okay.
Which was really fun, but I decided, nah, there's no point. I didn't want to keep that around. I wasn't going to take the risk because of one of the problems I started running into, which was dry hopping aggressively at the 2.5 to 3 pounds plus per barrel sort of level initially.
Mm-hmm.
And the beers were great for about a week or two. And then, oh no, butter popcorn. That thing
So you mean in the finished beer? So not even like a week or two, like end of fermentation, still in the fermenter.
Yeah.
You've now kegged.
Hop creep, as people like to say, in the finished beer, right? And so in the beginning, I'm like, I know homebrewing. I've done this a million times. I'm not even going to check. I'm not even going to de-check. I'm not going to check my FG. I think I'm good. You know what I mean?
Or maybe, enough time.
Maybe you check the finished gravity a little bit. You just kind of look and think you're fine, whatever. And then all of a sudden, I started running into these issues that are hop creep related on the back end. And I'm like, uh-oh.
Right.
If I really want to enjoy this again and try and get good at it again, I got to figure out what's going on there, what's really diving into it. So,
yeah
you got this interaction between hops and yeast and any kind of enzymatic activity that could be happening at that point. There's a bunch of different ways you can try and control those variables to avoid hop creep. Well, one of the things I thought that was really interesting and different from trying to do this in 2008 to 2014, which is when the last time I was brewing just tons and tons of pale ales, is hops are kilned oftentimes at a lower temp now than they were before, and there's different hop products that are available. And thanks to my friends at Alvarado Street and at Cellar Maker and at Faction, all three of those breweries were kind enough to give me super high quality hops during that first early phase of the pandemic. And extra shout out to all three of those breweries. That was super awesome and fantastic, and I tried to compensate in return, and they would give me, you know, a few pounds of this, few pounds of that, and which was awesome because I think in particular, when these guys gave me cryo, the quality there was incredible and amazing, right? And I could not necessarily use it two for one, but kind of look at the dry hop in a different way. But I think universally across the board, because I was getting these high quality hops from all these sources that I trusted, I knew that they were current crop year. I knew that they were fresh, and you could smell and get a really clear perception that they were fresh right off the bat. But I think because most modern hops versus 10 years ago are kilned at a little bit lower temp across the board, especially these guys were kind enough to give me stuff, you know, that you'd mostly want. And this is what I was using for pale ale production, like Simcoe, Citra, Mosaic, and cryo versions of some of each of those, and then a little bit of New Zealand hops, which I was able to get on the side also. But just focusing mostly for this particular pale ale experiment, focusing mostly on those hops.
Okay.
Yeah, just...
So not even Centennial, not going back to Chinook.
Bit of Chinook, a little bit of Centennial, a little bit of Amarillo, but that was mainly on the hot side, right? Those, the cold side, which was where I tried to troubleshoot this, was focused on hops like those. And because of that lower kilning temperature, one of the ideas, and I think, I don't know if this has been completely proven, Vito, correct me if you know for sure, that there may be the potential for more enzymatic activity because they're kilned at a lower temperature.
So like I've seen Vinny talk from Russian River about that, and he actually showed data like supporting that. And it was actually a problem that the hop, there's like 50, 60 breweries that kind of work closely with the hop.
The consortium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they had them lower the kilning temperature because like, whoa, the fruits and, you know, the aromatics is so much better. But the difference or what happened, at least how Vinny explained it, was, you know, at that higher kilning temperature, it's specifically the AMG enzyme, the amyglucidase, I believe it's pronounced, which people, you know, you guys probably remember brewed IPAs. That was like the big thing to dry those out. That's the enzyme people were adding to achieve that. Anyways, that's naturally present on hops and fruit and all kinds of things for that matter. But by kilning it at that lower temperature, they weren't denaturing that enzyme.
Okay.
So, you know, create it better hops in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, but then also create it hop creep.
I see.
Was kind of how that happened. So, you know, fast forward to here we are now.
Like anything in brewing, there's a trade-off, right?
Yeah.
You make one thing better and something else may suffer for it, or you may have some other battle to fight, right? And that seems to be what's emerging here. You know?
And just like you said happened to you, I think a lot of these brewers, you know, especially that have been making great beers for so long, they didn't change their process. They didn't know they need to. So everything's going fine. I'm just going to do what I do. Probably won't even check the final gravity anymore because I've been doing this for a decade.
Right.
And then it's like, oh no, it's in my beer too.
Like I didn't want to admit it at first because I really felt like I know what I was doing. I'm like, no, it's not there. It's not because it's when it's hop creep. You start getting it slowly, right?
The only other person drinking your beer, the person drinking your beer the most besides you is Nicole Ernie.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's no hiding from any flaws in your beer.
You are the
light lager of brewers, Nate.
Indeed,
there's not one flaw that you can hide from.
Indeed, it kind of made it awesome though. There's no way I could hide from it or deny the fact that it was happening. I think I kind of sensed it too, but I would give it to Nicole, and that was always the litmus test. You know, she would have off days too a little bit, but especially as it started to emerge, she'd be like, yeah, Nate, it's there.
Sorry, bro.
Yeah. And it wasn't every time, but it was often enough where I felt like I really had something to troubleshoot in that aspect. I think that's one of the trickier aspects of brewing a pale ale on the homebrew side. That if you really wanted to stand up to some of the best commercial examples that you'll find,
you got to hop it like that.
You got to hop it like that. You really got to hop it kind of aggressively, and so your variables to try to control that. You have a few different ways in which you can attack this, right? Even starting with kind of the beginning of making the beer. So one of the ways in which I wanted to make the perfect pale ale was like, well, let me skip these crystal or kind of unfermentable malts, and I'll control that through mash temp. Well, I started wondering, am I leaving too many unfermentable sugars in the final beer? Am I leaving starch behind, basically?
Okay.
And is there something in that? Is the enzymes that are in the hops that Vito touched on and talked about, are they actually converting some starch that's left behind, and then that's kicking up a fermentation again? And that's where I'm getting the acetyl, right?
Okay.
So you could try and attack it from that angle, or especially when I was trying to repitch yeast and think about yeast health and viability was I not giving the yeast enough calcium to begin with, right?
Okay.
And in the San Francisco Bay Area, especially in the East Bay where we're at here at the Hop Grenade, and I live where on this side of the Bay Area too, our water tends to be fairly soft, and we have to do something if we want to just use our tap water, carbon block filtered, to get the enough calcium content for things to work correctly at the yeast metabolism and yeast health level kind of long term. And I was kind of being a little bit lackadaisical in that at the beginning. So that was one thing, another variable to dial in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And without, because I've always been too lazy to do RO water. You could do RO and then just build it up from scratch. But in the Bay Area, you got pretty good starting point. If you get, Vito turned me on to this too. And I go to people I trust like Vito and talk about this issue I was having in brewing and be like, well, you encourage me, well, do you test your water? Do you know where you're starting from? And I'm like, no, kind of lazy about that. I should probably, you'll probably check. And you could, there's a lot of great kits out there. Morbi sells a few of those, along with many other suppliers these days. And they work really well to give you a sense of like, where are you starting from? So you don't necessarily have to do RO if you're trying to get to a certain calcium or chloride level. I was just making sure I was seeing something like 50 100 parts per million calcium as kind of a baseline for like yeast health. I'm like, okay, am I somehow pissing off the yeast and there's precursor diacetyl left behind and that's just happening in during the hop creep phase? So that was another angle to troubleshoot. Kettle hot side, super hot side, not as much troubleshoot there, other than the this idea that if I was doing over dry hopping and doing too much on the whirlpool side, they could kind of be, there could be some kind of a symbiotic relationship there a little bit between the two.
Okay.
And they may be kind of amplifying each other. The real problems, I think, that in my particular case, and in most people's case are trying to do this at home, we're controlling the fermentation, pitch rate, viability, dry hopping level, temperature of dry hopping, those kind of things. I think adjusting those variables really, really started to fix the issue long term, but it was fairly iterative. It wasn't just one thing. It was like all these things kind of working in conjunction. Just taking dry hop alone, I think there's some pretty, Tom Schellhammer had done some research on this a number of years ago, and it's out there, and I forget exactly where the references are, but if you guys search for it, you'll find it. He talked a lot about what sort of dry hopping levels can you push to the max before you get kind of diminishing returns, mm-hmm. right? And there are plenty of IPA brewers who push way beyond that these days. And I think that's fine. I don't want to necessarily say that anyone who's going 4 or 5 pounds per barrel is wrong. But in particular, thinking about a smaller, more delicate beer like this, like a pale ale, that's somewhere in the range of like 4.5 to 5% ABV. Is like I was shooting for original gravity somewhere in like the 1040 to kind of 1050 range max. And then finishing gravity fairly pretty dry around the 106 to 108. Kind of range, so like, you know, 1.5 to 2 Plato or so. You want to approach the dry hop maybe with these kind of guidelines that that Schellhammer talked about, where it's like, okay, 2 to 2.5 pounds per barrel range is probably kind of about the max where you're gonna get a much benefit. And I think on the home brewing level, that's kind of along the range of like 1 to 1.5 or 1.7 ounces per gallon.
Okay.
That kind of range. And in the beginning,
that's a safe spot, you're saying.
That's kind of a starting point for if you think you have these kind of issues like I was talking about. And if you really don't necessarily want to waste hops, or if you want to think about what might be optimal based on the research that's out there. And in the beginning, I was like doubling that just for fun.
Okay.
Like,
you're going 3 ounces.
I got these great hops for my friends. Let me just use them. It'll be awesome. Like, let's go 3 ounces or more. I think that was potentially contributing to the problem. So one of the ways to troubleshoot it, like you were asking, was like, okay, let me bump that down to like 1 to 1.7 ounces.
Okay.
And I think that helps.
Yeah.
And I think the actual hop impact was better.
Okay.
And sometimes commercial brewers will talk about this.
The less is more.
That less can be more. It's maybe for a delicate beer, that's particularly true. I think the exception to that is when I talk to folks who do super modern, like Scott Janish was someone that I'd had a cool discussion with this stuff about a month and a half ago, and that Sapwood, I know they do super low temps for their dry hop, and they really push that boundary of how much
like
dry
what
hop
is
they
a low
do.
Temp?
Down in the 50s, right? Down in the 50s or lower
than that,
I think.
It's a different flavor, definitely,
yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to go back to the dry hop too. Was it all T90 pellets or you said cryo as well?
All T90 and cryo.
Okay.
Those were the two.
What were like the percentage? You'll probably get into it. The percentages of cryo to pellet.
It kind of depended on what I had and what I liked, what you know, you break part and smell it. I think, you know, different than years ago where we really kind of fixate on a specific variety and only trying to get that. I think if you have it, it's fresh. You like the kind of the basic profile of it. Is it an expressive American hop like Simcoe, Citra, Mosaic? And you have enough of it to kind of hit a target that you want. I think about those a little more interchangeable than maybe we used to years ago. And part of that's just because we're spoiled. And there's so many good kind of craft brewing focused American hops now that you can use in those spots. I think, you know, quantity, time, temperature, and like original gravity of the beer are almost even equally, if not more important to hit a target of making something
than variety
delicious than variety to some extent.
What about cryo specifically though? And I'm wondering if this is kind of where you're asking, Vito. Yeah. Is cryo less likely to contribute to hop creep?
Exactly.
Yeah. It is because it doesn't have
the vegetal matter.
I see.
Yeah.
So cryo is less vegetal matter, which means less enzymes.
So where that enzyme is going to exist is in the vegetal matter
on the outside, the exterior of the hop plant. Yeah, where the cryo is like more the pure center lupulin, right? So I would assume you'd get less of that enzyme from cryo.
Because I can picture the first thing our hop head listeners are thinking when you say pull back the hops, they're like, wow. Okay, but I still want it to be dank. But this is a way you can pull back the T90, you can pull back that vegetal matter and then increase the dank or whatever you're looking for in that case by adding cryo, right?
By adding cryo. Yeah, okay. You're right, Vito. That should be a good control mechanism or at least one way in which you can dial down that knob a little bit potentially, like lower the potential that
But
that
you'd still maybe get down to like 1.3, whatever, 1.5 in ounces. But not reducing the dank factor or those other hot factors that you're looking for with the addition of cryo, right?
Maybe even getting more of what you want in theory because you should have I think the original way it was kind of pitched to brewers was like double or kind of like double bang for the buck in terms of like per ounce, you know, per unit of measure that.
Yeah, because it's also double the price. So that's a great
pitch. Well, indeed, exactly.
So they're like, don't worry, double the price.
You got to double
the alpha assets
somehow.
Too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So, okay, so you found that there was a lot of it coming from these new world hops and in high doses, I've heard the pro brewers come in here whenever hop creep has come up. I mean, whenever they dumb it down for me, that's kind of what it comes down to is new world hops. And I actually either haven't been told or wasn't listening about the kilning process actually contributing to it, but I'm sure I've heard that on the show too. So, interesting. We're going to take a break because we've got a lot more to cover. But that's definitely a perfect start to Nate finding his perfect pale ale. So not only do we have more to talk about from Nate and his input, but just as a little teaser, I went through and dug up some old notes from when I got to brew Pale 31 with Matt Brynelson over at Firestone there. And even more enjoyable for me, and I think our listeners, was I found a bunch of notes in a conversation between Matt and Tasty on that beer, where Matt was soliciting some advice from Tasty on how we might even make Pale 31 a little more modern. And so I'm curious how Tasty's notes might stand up to some of the things that you found.
Oh, this will be good. So, we have contributions from Tasty.
I love it.
Pale 31 and Tasty live on.
Exactly.
The two things we miss dearly.
All right, so hang in there. You're listening to The Session, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. We are with Nate Smith and Vito DeLucci talking my favorite, talking the perfect pale ale. Which I never brewed, but Nate is on a quest. Are you still on the quest?
I'm still on the quest, not as often as I would want these days. I got to recapture that magic, you know, recapture that what was the, you know, best you can make of a bad situation, perhaps, you know what I mean? among the successes and the fails, it was cool to do along the way and really like dive into all the hands-on nuts and bolts of homebrewing. I mean, there are some fun, spectacular fails along the way. So in the beginning of the pandemic, we also had this weird sort of 3 or 4 month period where you couldn't get CO2.
Or at least
not very easily, right? So I kind
of
ran out of what I had or I was getting really low. So I'm like, I'll keg condition this pale ale. Because I had keg conditioned, I had a Belgian single on, you know, called Fascist Servitude Obliteration. So I had that 60 shilling called Catastrophic Capitalist Suffocation Curse, right? Can't condition both of those. And the American Stout, Nightmares in the Human Collapse.
Deep
respect to my friends who I stole the name from that on. Look that up. They're a great band. Name of their song. Anyway, so I'd keg conditioned all those successfully. And that was great. So I'm like, all right, cool. Thinking I'm like a badass British cask brewer style guy. Like,
yeah.
I can keg condition anything. This is fine.
Like, can I ask you real quick, I don't want to divert us, but you do say successfully, and I assume that you mean that you got it to the right carbonation level that you wanted. But
exactly.
I'm curious, too, if there was a flavor difference that you noticed in keg conditioning.
Not a flavor difference, okay. But to me, when you ferment in the vessel that you're serving from, you can smell kind of an ester or, to me, it was almost like a slight phenol.
Oh.
Like that yeast under pressure that's creating the CO2 for you in the finished product is under more stress. And so it's going to act a little differently. And to me, it was getting like whatever character that yeast had to begin with. And to me, it seemed like kind of a phenol.
Okay.
You'd smell it.
Okay.
A little bit.
That makes sense.
Some people will talk about the size of the bubble or the quality of the
carbon. Yeah.
I'm not going to discount that. People who know way more about this than me are probably much better brewers and cellar people, but I've never been able to perceive a difference there.
Okay.
But it's kind of fun to keg condition those beers. So I'm like, let's keg condition American Pale Ale. That'll be awesome.
Yeah.
So bad.
Oh, really?
So terrible. So god awful. I think you can do it. I'm sure you can certainly do it. But
sure.
This was already, it had already been finished and dry hopped and everything. Something about that additional fermentation activity, warm, because you want it warm enough where you can kind of cake it. It was just transform the hop flavors into something that.
Wow.
It was a dumper.
Tell that to Sierra Nevada.
No, I know. I think there are people way more skilled than me to pull this off.
Figured it out,
You find your own limits. You're like, oh, yeah, I can do this. It'll be cool. It'll be great. It'll be like better pale ale than ever. It's like, nope. Bad, awful, terrible. I mean, I could have made some mistake along the way, but like a basic thing, like I didn't clean something well enough or something like that.
Sierra Nevada is doing such low DO brewing. Like, from like the malt, the mill side all the way through. So that, I could see them, the science is there on their end.
Key point, Vito. I think what I learned in trying to do this universally was that controlling DO, at the homebrewing level is really tough.
Sure.
Especially when you want to nail certain kinds of hop flavors, like the benefits you get from DO control in a modern brewery and especially for hoppy brewing at the modern scale that we want to do it, these really aggressively hopped beers and dry hop beers, it's increasingly becoming harder to do that at the homebrew level and control DO. That was one of the things I didn't mention earlier when you asked me about how to troubleshoot this problem. So a function of fermentation is oxygen exposure, right? So if you have oxygen exposure anywhere along the way, you may be increasing this potential for hop creep, right? Or issues you're going to have in general with the fermentation persisting in ways that you didn't want it to.
Okay.
Harder for a homebrewer to do that than not.
I always describe it kind of like similar to a barrel. The smaller the barrel, the more surface area of the wood, right? With the liquid.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same with oxygen, right? Like, so the smaller your batch size, the easier it is to oxidate that. So we're like big batches, there's so much liquid, it's just easier to protect it.
It really is. Yeah. That's
you're fighting a losing battle on the smaller end.
Yeah, you really are. On the homebrew level, you're always going to be tiny compared to something that on the commercial scale, 7, 10, 12 barrels or more, even at least,
Well, then does this lend to the argument for dry yeast? Because not even aerating your wort.
It does a bit, or you don't necessarily have to aerate the dry yeast. And that took a little bit of a leap of faith in my old school brewing.
Yeah,
skills. I'd be like, I want to hydrate. You got to hydrate that. It's the only way to be
able to. Like,
nope, just dump it in. Yeah. And Vito, you're one of the people that can encourage me to do that. You're like, no, don't even do that. Don't even hydrate it like we used to in the old days. You can just dump that stuff in. I'm like, this is great. It gets to be lazy.
Right.
More time to play guitar and do other stuff. Whatever the fuck.
Right, but it feels like jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. Mm-hmm. Right? Your first time doing it.
I know you're a little too comfortable with dry yeast, so I'm like, this stuff is great. It kind of like...
it does anything. It kinda,
back to the
I can't even fuck it up.
Back to the old, I think it was the debutante stripper analogy, right? It's like, you can do anything or whatever, right? So I'm just like, one of the other fails among the keg conditioning pale ale thing is like, okay, you read the specs for dry yeast. I think it's USO5 in this case. I don't want to pick on those guys. It's great yeast, I thought. But it's like, you can go up to 72 or 74. I'm like, cool. Let me just ferment it at 72.
Yeah,
then.
Why not?
Nah, bad idea. Okay, I think my D problems were worse with that one.
Okay.
In trying to mess with that. But yeah, you got to have some fails along the way when you're trying to experiment. You get a little cocky sometimes. You feel like you figured stuff out, or you can push the limits. But
yeah,
if you're brewing enough and you're not afraid to dump stuff, I mean, that was sort of where I was at with a little bit of it too. You know what I mean? Like, of course, I wanted to drink everything I was producing, but if I was doing batch splitting, it would get a little weird on one of them and have to dump it. You know, it was okay. I figured I was going to be brewing again in a couple weeks.
Right.
I love that the world's making sourdough and Nate's making pale ale.
He's making pale ale.
I was doing that too, but that's now, a different show. But
wouldn't keg conditioning alone solve the hop creep
that
problem?
Well, not just solve the hop creep. Maybe it would certainly help with the oxygen part, but yeah, in a sense, and maybe in the way that, like, okay, if there's anything left to ferment or if there's any yeast left in solution, then you've given them a job to do.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be chewing on whatever stuff might be left over and producing D off of that.
But that's not what you found?
Well, I think it could work in that way, but it destroyed the flavor in other ways from sitting warm too long. I think the problem is like the way that we interpret like great fresh hoppy pale ale. Thanks, Wynn, for the one like we have in front of us right now. The thing is, had only cold exposure to all those like really delicate hop oils.
Okay.
And those things are so volatile. If you're trying to do keg conditioning and letting that thing sit at 68 or 70 for 4 or 5 days to let it condition, those hop oils are just degrading and turning into terrible tasting, what we would think is like a stale or oxidized kind of an IPA. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that was I had fun names for all these. I think that was like Wings of Despair, like the third one that I did. I tried keg conditioning. After that, it didn't work out as well.
So. Dude, I want you to have a whole line of pale ales. Not only because I love pale ales, I know that you're a great brewer, but the names would just be so good.
Yeah,
I just want
it was the Despair series. It was like,
if I had more money, Nate, I would build a brewery just for your named pale ales. is what I would do.
Thank you, sir.
Should we talk a little bit about malt, especially since I teased Tasty's input into this?
Let's do that.
So one of the things you were talking about either at the beginning of the show or maybe even before we started is, and I was mentioning too, the really wide array of pale ales that there are now. So for example, we had a Row 2 Hill 56 in our glass at the start of this show. That's from Russian River, an all Simcoe pale ale.
Yep.
That's wildly different than the pale ale we have in our glass now from Wondrous, which is called Straight Leg. This one is lighter, drier, and I would say even dankier, even though the other one's all Simcoe.
Yeah, it has Mosaic, I believe. Not there's another hop component, but it has much more of an earthy, dank sort of thing.
Right.
Both great pale ales, but different.
Both great pale ales. And I
cool
would
having them back to back like this for that reason, Justin. Yeah.
It is. And I do think that one might subscribe to the Tasty advice I'm about to give more than the other. I think maybe the Wondrous beer is a little more on the Tasty side, which would make sense, by the way. Wynn was like a protege
indeed
of Tasty. Okay, so this came up. We were brewing Pale 31 again. We were reviving Pale 31 because I had made fun of Firestone Walker for getting rid of it. I made a funeral video and sent it to them, which made Matt really sad. And then he invited me to come revive it, put our Hop Grenade logo on it, which was super cool. And anyhow, he brought in Tasty too in an email thread. And he said, hey, Tasty, you know that we're about to do this beer with Justin. Tasty was still ill at this time, but he was well enough to talk and communicate. He was going out from time to time, but he couldn't go to the brewery with us. But in this email, he gave his advice, and he gave a little bit of his own experience where he said back in 08, he had blended, and he probably told this story on the air, he had blended a double IPA, which was a Pliny clone at the time, with a Dortmunder with a ratio of about 75% Dort. And the result, he thought, was this American pale ale that advanced to the second round of the HA national competition. And he really liked that. And since he made it to the second round, he had to brew it again, but he didn't want to brew two beers. So he just figured out a way to combine those two recipes. And the result, if you've been listening to the Brewing Network a long time, I'm sure you won't find this a surprise, but it was to, the base malt breakdown came to, he added 14% Pilsner and 86% pale. So some sort of two row pale malt.
Yeah.
Right? And this was kind of the advice that he was giving to Matt, knowing Matt's malt bill at the time, which had two row Munich and Carapils in it. the OG Pale 31. I'm not going to give all the you know, I don't know if that's proprietary stuff, but I think everybody knows that those three were in there. So Tasty was like, hey, if you are trying to modernize this a little bit, simplify. But Tasty was still a fan of two malts, right? He didn't just want it to be all pale malt or all two row or even all Pilsner, right? He still wanted two malts in there. So
it's a beer that you have, it's delicate enough where you have the ability to play around with that on the malt bill side. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to go crazy and use an aggressive, super assertive malt, but blending base malts is one way to mm-hmm. achieve that. I think that's pretty cool and lends a kind of subtle complexity that's interesting and kind of in a maybe slightly intangible way. Like, okay, you have a malt like Munich, which is a little bit toasty, mm-hmm. or which is different than you have certain forms of two row, even up to something like Marisotto, which has like a slight biscuit kind of quality to it, right? So you can play with those kind of levers a little bit, right? Or on the other end of the spectrum, to kind of fill it all out, use something like a base American two row, which is just going to kind of support everything else.
Right.
Using those as kind of your character malts instead of trying to throw a super aggressive, like, you know, C120 or something
yeah.
at
right.
it.
Right? Yeah.
Something like that. Those are great malts, but not necessarily ones you'd want to do for the modern way lens in which we look at these kind of pale ales. You know what I mean? I think Munich in particular was mentioned here. Mm-hmm. Small amounts of that, or even moderate to higher amounts of Pilsner malt, I think can work really well. I was looking back through my notes before to prepare for our discussion today. I think the sixth iteration I did of this idea, I called it Shadows of Despair that time, right?
Yes.
I pushed the limits on Pilsner malt and did 50-50. Pilsner malt and Rar Turo. Really like that effect.
50-50.
I think yeah. it achieved something maybe similar to what Munich would have done in Pale 31. I think the level of Munich wasn't quite high at 50% by no means.
Sure,
but
yeah.
That flavor contribution from the Zweirman pills I was using in this case, kind of similar to what you would get through Munich, that kind of toasty, melanoidin kind of range of flavors. Munich's much more intense along those lines, but you know, a German produced malt like any kind of Weirman Pils or Munich, if you incorporate that into a pale, I think that's one of the secret keys on the malt bill side to creating kind of the best version of a pale ale, or you know, your ideal version of a pale ale of what you might have out there. I think Carafoam or Carapils is another thing you could introduce too, but that
yeah.
one
give a little body, good head
yeah,
retention.
For a little bit of yeah. body and head retention, you know, maybe a couple percent, not do too much, but just a little bit might be an interesting variable to play with.
When we you know, when we talk about modern IPA, modern pale ale, you know, we were talking about it off the era. One of Tasty's tips was take out the crystal malt. You know, that was
yeah.
one that he would say. You know, it helps with the hop creep or that hop side, and then also the staling side of things too. So yeah. like that was kind of like a tip that you know.
Yeah, I had yeah. forgotten about that part. Not the get rid of crystal, because that was a mantra of his.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I forgot about the staling benefit
yeah.
of it. Yeah,
when crystal malts kind of start to turn in a beer, we have that. It's like of our baseline association with like kind of that stale cardboardy side of beer. It seems like that the higher crystal malt focused beers that can kind of come out in a way. Especially with a hoppy crystal malt driven beer, for whatever reason, that whenever that starts to come out, they can just seem to amplify each other.
Okay.
And yeah. it doesn't seem to be very pleasant for whatever reason.
Right. So did you end up in your process find an ideal malt combo?
As I got to the point where I thought I was fixing those diacetyl issues, like introducing, because I'd started using Crystal 55 or Crystal 60 in the beginning, like the first one I did was Bat Venom Abyss. And that had like... that had like yeah. like 3% or 4% like English Crystal 55, right? I deleted that pretty quickly as I did like the second or third iteration, right? But by the time I was getting to, I think it was like, I just called it Shadow Despair at the end. It was kind of one of the names I'd settled on for this beer. I'd not quitting Crystal 55 back in, but you were talking a little bit about Carafoam Munich or Carapils.
Carapils, yeah.
Carapils or Carafoam. I think you can use those a little bit in that slot. I kind of like Carafoam.
And Carapils is what Carapils. Pale 31 used, too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit. Not necessarily to give it flavor, but maybe to give it head retention, like you're saying, Vito, and a little bit of body. But pretty simple on the other aspects of it. I'd use maybe something as unusual as a acidulated malt, which is not all that weird for kind of hoppy beer production, just to get the pH of the mash into focus. You could do that through other means too, and that's kind of
lactic acid or phosphoric
exactly. acid. The acidulated malt's kind of expensive way to do it. Oats, if you want a little bit of that kind of hazy aspect into it a little bit. Kind of didn't really do too much of that in this series of experiments, but wanted wanted a little bit of element of that in a couple cases. Didn't really stick with it though, because I wanted to keep the malt bill side really simple. But for a classic, clear kind of West Coast style American pale ale, I think if you're doing a blend of any kind of two row that you like, with a little bit of something that has a German malted flavor to it, like Munich or Pils, you know, I think that's one of the keys to make it work. Another interesting wild card on the malt bill side is like Maris Otter. Mm-hmm. This is one that McDowell talked about a lot years ago too. Is kind of a cool thing for not just pale ale but IPA brewing, like, you know, 10%, maybe 10-15%, to kind of give it this interesting, intangible, slight biscuity side to the malt. Blending base malts, I guess, is kind of, if you could, maybe one basic takeaway.
Yeah.
Blend base malts that you like.
Okay.
And ones that would kind of work in any kind of pale beer. I think that's one way you could approach this and still have fun with it and make it your own.
So if you sort of started this talk with this 50-50 pale 50, pilsner,
yep.
What you're saying now is you might go like 45-45 and then mix in some carapils. Or,
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, Justin. Yeah, 45-45 or 48-48 and then kind of fill in the rest with like a carafoam or carapils.
Or maybe even
a touch of oats or Maris Otter or something like that. Go 40-40
to
and
your
then fill in the rest with Maris Otter and just a touch of acidulated or a carafoam or something like that. That's most of what you need. You can go a little crazier if you want something specific, but I think it's a little more perilous after that. Because after all, like,
and that, of course, is for this kind of modern West Coast style pale ale, right? That is not, for example, to make a Sierra Nevada pale ale.
No.
Right? Sierra Nevada pale ale is still going to have some
crystal kind of C60, kind of C55, kind of C60 range in it, you know, and just because it was the holidays recently, we probably all had a celebration or two or saw that kicking around.
So many.
Such a crystal malt driven beer, right?
And but it's still so delicious.
Still a classic.
Love it. And so is pale ale.
Hating on crystal malts, you know what I'm saying? In the right context, especially in the right way. Yeah. Absolutely. Like that.
sure. But just what you were, just to clarify to folks at home, especially if you're getting new into this, this is a new school West Coast pale ale that we're really...
New school West Coast pale ale, primarily, that we're talking about. Yeah, hazy versions of it that have a lot of wheat notes and so forth. That's it's a different dragon to slay for a different day, I guess. You know what I'm saying?
Like, same concept, increase the protein.
I think Matt and Mike's discussion around that, though, was pretty cool. It was nice to have both a beer that we can't enjoy anymore, Pale 31, and we don't have Mike here on the mic, sadly, anymore to talk about it with us.
So he would have loved it, too. He'd be sitting right there just... Well, he'd mostly be listening to you, because he loved to learn about... He would have loved the results of your experiments, and of course, would have been able to contribute with some of his own. So I definitely thought it was... Plus, it was just such great advice. And it's funny, too. I didn't read the top of the email. The top of the email, when Matt wrote to him to request his advice, you know, Mike was like, Tasty goes, well, I'm hard pressed to even attempt to improve Pale 31.
It's true. Back to something you mentioned in the beginning before I forget too, Justin. I think Pale 31, technically, when they were producing it at scale, had a little bit of... double barrel,
so
blended in with it, didn't it?
Now this is a great. I'm glad you bring that up. And I thought that I read that reference in this email.
Yeah,
but you know where I found it, where I was reminded of it on the More Beer website. Mm-hmm. I went to look to see if the Pale 31 kit was still available, and my old ass DVD still are. Yeah. I'll put links in the show notes to those of you listening. But you can buy an extract kit and an all-grain kit for Pale 31. You can also buy the old Brewing Network DVD, which honestly was one of the best products we ever put out. That is me and Matt brewing together, and Matt describing, you know, every step of the process. I read in the... I wanted to read the reviews of the kits to see what people thought. And in one of the comments is where I was reminded. It must have been a Brewing Network listener, I think, who heard it on here and went in and commented and said, well, by the way, sure, this is the recipe for Pale 31, like according to Matt, but the OG Pale 31 was X percentage of Mission Street Pale Ale and X percentage of, I think, Union Jack. I don't know if it was Double Barrel.
Thank you.
It might have been Union Jack, because it was still quite... It might have been all three. That's not what this comment said. But anyway, praise to the usefulness of the More Beer website when they are reviewing recipe kits. You can go get some pretty good info from homebrewers right there.
That's some good beer and pro homebrewing history kind of captured in the back alleys of the internet right there between right. Brewing Network, Tribal Knowledge, and stuff that was archived on yes. More Beer website. That's super cool.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a blend. Yeah, you might be right. It could have been all three of those at one
point. I do
point,
think but. I remember Union Jack being in there. And in such a way, by the way, that the and it's probably one of, I don't, this is not insider information. One of the reasons the beer was canceled is not just that at the time, pale ales were losing popularity. But they had to brew two, maybe three beers on the same day in order to get Pale 31.
Oh, that's what they're doing.
Because it wasn't like they were taking finished tanks.
I see. I thought there was a finished beer.
No, so did I. Okay. When I talked to Matt about it, no, they had to plan a brew day where both of those beers were needed on their own, and a portion of them could go together for Pale 31, right? But it
awesome,
was so...
but a nightmare, too. Right?
Oh, yeah. The beer production geek in me loves that idea, but in terms of trying to
do that...
But
his team hated it.
Yeah, in terms of trying to actually do that day in and day out on a schedule,
but
that's a nightmare.
But it was so successful. It was so wildly successful from an award standpoint, from a consumer standpoint, until Pale Ale faded out of the light, which now is back in the spotlight as people, even hopheads, are like, yeah, I don't always want an IPA. I would love a Pale Ale.
Are we getting there? So, is that what's happening right now?
I think we are.
I hope so.
Yeah. Look, I'm not telling you that IPAs are declining in popularity. What I am telling you is that brewers, and I think in part due to this process that you're doing, Nate, are brewing more and more pale ales. And I think it's because they can be hoppier, danker, drier, closer to an IPA with a lower alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, which is something, again, Tasty talked about for years. I mean,
absolutely.
I would call Tasty the inventor of the session IPA. You know, that's probably could be argued. But when he was messing with his pale ale in this way, he was thinking of a session IPA.
Yeah.
He wasn't really thinking of a pale ale. He was thinking of a hoppy-ass beer that drank like a pale ale. And that's what he ended up with, a session IPA.
And you're reminding me, when I was going through this quest in mid-early 2020, Tim and Connor published this. They were kind of always trying to wave
from
the
Cellar
banner
Maker?
For... Yeah, from yeah. Cellar Maker. From, yeah. Sorry. Tim and Connor from Cellar Maker were kind of always trying to wave the banner for pale ale. Like, drink more pale ale. They would say this in their promo material and stuff like that when they would release West Coast pale ales. And they published a recipe called Nelson Nugs, and it was obviously a pale ale built around Nelson. I didn't have a bunch of that at the time, but I had stolen a bunch of those ideas and techniques for everything I integrated into this kind of quest for the ultimate pale ale. So shout out to Tim and Connor for being awesome to share what they would do for how they like making pale ales, but for keeping that idea alive of like, hey, pale ale is just as good as IPA, everybody. Like,
and they're still
doing
that.
You should be drinking more pale ale, everybody who likes IPAs. And I always thought that idea was cool.
We have, in fact, we have their hazy pale ale is on tap now. Their naming scheme's a little different than yours. There's the pale ale that we have on tap from them is called Tiny Dangster.
That's a great beer.
It's a great name.
It's a good one. A
different musical inspiration than yours, I would say.
Not Bat Venom Abyss or Apocalyptic Despair or Strata Despair or Nightmares in the Human Collapse.
Right. But then, and before we move on, just the Hop Grenade, we hosted the first ever, at least for us, and I think probably maybe the first in existence, we had a Pale Ale Festival this year right here at the Hop Grenade.
You did. I'm sad to miss it, but I'll catch the next one. That's a cool thing. And I think you're doing what you can to keep this,
keep
this idea alive, right? You know?
Not wildly successful from a ticket sales standpoint, but massively successful from a brewer standpoint. I just sent out brewery invites for Spring Brews Fest. It'll take about a month and a half before my list is finalized. When I sent out the Pale Fest invite, I got most of my answers within 24 hours.
Hell yeah.
Every brewer was awesome. Yep, done, and thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for what you're doing.
Can we send you two? They're all like, yeah, brewers just love it.
Brewers know they want a pale ale at the end of the day, usually, if they're into hoppy beers at all. You know what I'm saying?
That's what I call my desert island beer.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is. Yeah. And feeling like in the middle of a pandemic where you're not necessarily, you know, I wasn't going out to shows or doing the other things I would normally do on the weekends. So if you're stuck on your own desert island at home, having a good homebrew pale ale was one aspect of that.
Yeah.
One of the successes of this that we haven't touched on yet, Vito, you really helped me a lot with this because I couldn't get my hands on it otherwise, was things you can do during ferment to limit diacetyl production.
Okay.
And you can add a chemical, ALDC, and there are a bunch of different producers for it.
Mm-hmm.
generally not available on the homebrew side, although it might be.
It is now.
It is now. Yeah, fantastic.
Definitely. Yeah, Cellar Science is packaging it in homebrew sizes.
And homebrew size,
it's like a tiny amount you need, right?
You don't need much. That's the thing.
So it is available for homebrewers.
Commercial homebrew.
And what does that do?
So it inhibits the production of diacetyl, basically. It stops it from being produced, or it's such low levels that it's below our threshold.
Okay.
So it just kind of kills diacetyl, yeah, or the production of diacetyl. VDK is the precursor to diacetyl.
Okay.
Now, I can't remember if it actually helps convert it into something inert, or if it stops it entirely. Yeah. I guess that's neither here nor there. Yeah. You basically add it at pitch time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and at dry hop time?
Yeah, I've been doing it at both times, and I believe Vinny said they're doing it at both times as well. So you could add it. There is a point in which it denatures based on pH, and I want to say it was like 4.3. So most finished IPAs, you're good, you know, because they're 4.7, 4.8.
Right, it's not going to do anything for you at that point. It's just going to denature as soon as it hits dilution.
It won't work in those lower pH environments. And then also temperature, obviously, so you can't use it, you know, on the hot side. But yeah, you could add it when you pitch your yeast, and then also when you dry hop as well. Because with that dry hop, you're going to get that second, you know, kick up of fermentation. So it's good to add it there as well.
Nice.
Yeah. Back in mid-2020, homebrewers couldn't get this. I knew it existed. I'd heard about it, podcasts and Brewing Network on the Hopper Brew School. We talked about it a little bit.
Yeah. You turned me on to it, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got it.
People started talking about it, so I was going to brew with Vito. Anyways, we were working on a collab beer at the time, and you had access to commercial ingredients.
But is it a magic bullet, or is it just a helper?
It's a helper. I don't think it's a magic bullet, but it's one that I think is key in order to brew maybe an ideal version of a West Coast pale ale like we would interpret it these days. It's a good tool in the toolbox, and you should probably just, if you're having issues like I was, if you're not having the problem, forget it. Maybe you're fine. If you're trying to fight hop creep like I was, like, try it, and it may help out. I think it's something that has become a little bit more universal on the commercial production side for people who are making a lot of these type of beers, just to try and make things more predictable.
And also the production time, you know, instead of doing that 4 days in the tank, doing a diacetyl rest, I now could turn that tank a lot quicker. So it allows you to, you know, produce more faster. So it helps greatly on that side.
I think a variation of this, or even in conjunction, if you're really paranoid, there's the Berkeley yeast guys have a yeast that
genetically modified yeast
that doesn't produce diacetyl at all, or at least that's the idea. I don't want to speak for these guys entirely, but I don't know if they're the only exclusive producer of something like that. They could be. That's another way in which you could approach this. I think that may be successful. So if you do that and something like ALDC, that should give you extra insurance on the fermentation side, that you won't have a lot of extra diacetyl to sort of contend with. You know, I think, though, you'd want to treat your ferments like you normally would in terms of time, temp, and pitch rate and everything like that. It's not a complete wild card, but it would help you control that.
Control is the key point.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
It doesn't kill it, but it lowers
Keep
it. You know,
good standard practice how you would otherwise.
Yeah.
But add, you know, potentially think about adding this and see if it helps. I think when you gave me that stuff, Vito, I immediately started using it. I thought it helped. It wasn't necessarily a magic bullet. I think it's, in some cases, I was still fighting it a little bit. But that also is a factor of pH, like you said. Mm-hmm. Was I using enough? This stuff is tough to dose on the homebrewing level. I mean, you were talking like I would pull like titrate out, pipette, like one in. That's it.
Okay.
So it was not much. And then you're kind of wondering if you did it right, you know, you do it while you're sober, right? You don't do it while, you don't do it after you had four pale ales, right?
Make your fingernails fall off.
Yeah, you gotta do it very carefully because it's such a small amount. But I think that's a key with the way that modern hops are produced and the way that we think about making these style of beers at the aggressive dry hopping rates in which we're approaching them.
Yeah,
stuff like ALDC or a diacetyl controlling yeast are probably a really important aspect of it that you can't just ignore.
Okay.
If you're really trying to hit it, if you're really trying to nail it time in and time out, I think that's a big factor. I mean, not going crazy with the dry hop, really trying to figure out ways in which you can control the ferment, including things like chemical or maybe yeast selection, and going lower on the temp. I mean, our old school, like 2008 advice, like, was like, maybe we could ferment it, ferment temp, you know, 68, 66, but maybe do that at a lower temp. Think about doing it at a lower temp.
Ferment or dry hop?
Dry hop, in the 50s. And when you're trying to control something like diacetyl in the finished beer, test for it. It's kind of a pain to do it and time consuming on the homebrew side, but you can do just a hot water bath style test for diacetyl. You can even go as far as to test for it before you dry hop, or certainly before you think the beer is done. Like I started doing that as a matter of practice when I was really trying to fight this on the finished beer for all these pale ales that I made, like be really honest with myself and study the method to do the hot water bath style.
Which is just to warm up a sample.
And the thing I was doing wrong in the beginning, though, is you really got to kind of hold it there.
Okay.
And I believe that...
And cap it, too.
Hold it and cap it. What sort of temp range do you normally do?
I want to say it's pretty warm, like 120, 110 degrees.
Indeed. Yeah, about 110, 120.
Pretty warm.
And try to keep it there for about how long?
Oh, 15, 20 minutes.
15, 20 minutes. It takes a while. That's typically what I think.
Interesting. Okay. And then pull off that cap.
Get in there right away. Yeah.
Chill it. You'll notice it. Maybe chill it first, too.
Okay.
Or smell it or chill it. Like, then you're going to get a good impression of, like, okay, is this thing really... Swirl it, smell it. Are you getting butter? And be honest with yourself. If you are, it's there. Wait, or find ways in which you could potentially control it.
The alcohol starts to show up at that point too. So it's really you got to cut through that, right? Because that wants to flow out at that.
That alcohol is going to volatilize off too.
I'm getting a lot of alcohol. Okay, I'm getting the butter there.
It's not a good beer by any means at that point. But if you're going to have butter diacetyl problems at that point, it's going to come through. The problem I was fighting though in trying to make this ideal pale ale thing was like, okay, if the beer's already dry hopped. I had a target for how long I wanted to sit on the dry hop, 6, 7, 8, 10 days. If it still had diacetyl problems, I wasn't going to pull it. There's no point.
Yeah.
So then you're over dry hopping or you're throwing off other parts of the process, which you can't really correct at that point, but you could think about how you might change for the future iteration of it. Yeah.
Going back to the cold dry hop, you know, something that probably helps there too. Is by lowering that temperature, all the yeast is flocking out, right? So that's totally, because that's what's happening.
Inhibiting yeast activity and just simply they're dropping out because it's too cold for them. And you
get rid of them out, and then not as much yeast present to get that re-fermentation going.
Your potential risk, though, and at the homebrew level, then is like, okay, if there's no yeast present, and you have a pretty cool target of where you want to dry hop for, your oxygen exposure is more of a factor then.
Mm-hmm.
So people think about yeast as absorbing oxygen if they're present.
They're not going to be there to scavenge.
They're not going to be there to scavenge or do anything, right? So you have something that's oxygen delicate
to mess
with. But better than producing a buttery flavor you don't like potentially, right?
So, well, because that can at least be solved by drinking faster, right?
Solved by drinking faster.
Whereas diacetyl, you're not solving.
Yeah. We go back to one of the points I made originally. It's like, okay, if I was making... this stuff and the D wasn't appearing for 2 weeks,
right?
But it was just basically me and Nicole or me and whoever's hanging out, stopping by and hanging out in the backyard drinking it.
Yeah,
I drank it faster and I wouldn't have noticed I had the problem.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, but without going through it that fast.
Without going through it that fast, the beer's going to sit for 2-3 weeks, and that was generally the time which I noticed it was starting to appear. Like that really awesome dry hop aroma and flavor would start to fall out. What comes to replace it? Is it just very slow O2 creep, or is it like, oh no, it's butter?
This is why, this is the one thing that stands out about me among our entire staff at the Brewing Network over the years, is that I don't think I'd ever suffer from diacetyl. If I could just brew a good beer in the first place, I do drink it all fast.
It would be gone quickly.
I'm like immune to these things. I don't even need any of this advice because mine's gone in a matter of days.
There were moments where I could tell it was turning and I'm like, I'm just going to have extra beer or two today then, because tomorrow's going to, I might just dump it tomorrow or 2 to 3 days from now. But anyways.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me do this. We don't have a ton of time. I don't know if you know this, Nate. We don't do 3-hour shows anymore around here.
I know. This is it.
It's now that we're our age. It's it's, you know, we can't do these marathons.
Bedtime approaches.
So we're gonna do a real quick break, and then maybe when we come back, you know, we can talk a little bit of like you just gave us, I think, a pretty good rundown of best practices. But I don't think I've heard, like, if you were to pick one right now, like, what's your best full recipe that you did? Could we maybe do that?
For sure.
All right. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, Nate's, let's call it, almost perfect depths of despair recipe.
Indeed.
Because it'll never be quite perfect. Hang in there. It's The Session. We'll be right back.
Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Their website features real-time inventory, which means if you can put it in your cart, they can guarantee it'll ship the same day by 4 p.m. on weekdays. Want easy and simple electric brewing? Check out the new Series 2 Mash and Boil, featuring an elevated grain basket so you don't have to calculate sparge water. Williams also features the full Kegland line, everything from Brewzilla to Maltzilla, and a huge selection of duo-tight fittings. Looking for a kegerator? Look no further than the Kegland Series X and Plus kegerators, which feature 4 and 8 keg capacity in a compact footprint, and free shipping to the lower 48. Interested in distilling? Look up their proven Williams American Bourbon and Brandy kits, as well as complete distilling equipment packages and conversion kits for popular systems like the Mash and Boil, Anvil, and the Grainfather. Check them out today. Go to williamsbrewing.com to browse their vast selection.
Welcome back to the session. Thanks for hanging out with us. We got just a little more to do today in our not 3-hour show, even though, you know, I could talk about Pale Ale for 3 days. I could have turned this into 3 shows. But what I thought we would do is try to eke out of Nate what he did come up with that might be his favorite recipe. Or
when I do this next,
yeah,
and that'll be sooner than later, this will be the starting point. So the 6th iteration that I did, well, let's just use the name that I kind of settled on as the final name for this beer, Shadow Despair, for the pale ale that I like to brew.
Yeah.
Here's the recipe. You want to go get into that,
yep,
basically? Yep. So I'm brewing 10 gallons. Keep that in mind. I'll keep the percentages and proportions fairly generic, but they're going to be the scaling factor there is going to lean back to that. So starting with a masher, I'm trying to hit about 152 degrees Fahrenheit, adding 2.5 grams of gypsum, 2.5 grams of calcium chloride for a water that's really soft or have very little ion content of each. That'll get me well above 100 of each of those components using equal proportions of each of those. And this is pretty simple in terms of components, but slightly complex on the malt bill side in terms of overall percentages.
Hang on, before you start the malt bill.
Yeah.
I want to talk about 152 really quick.
Yeah.
Is that a result of your hop creep experiments? And I'm asking,
it is.
I don't have a lot of knowledge about this, but I'm just going to point out, since we use Pale 31 as an example,
yep,
he's a 145 guy.
Mm. Ah, interesting.
Of course, yeah, he's using old school hops too, right?
He is using old school hops.
So, you know, they're still great hops. But so anyway, did you land it at 152 as part of the hop creep experiment?
I did, and I actually even started higher than that to begin
okay
with, which I think was actually, you were mentioning important variable though, Justin. I think when I was doing these in the first 2, 3, 4 iterations, like Bat Venom Abyss, like the first one, yeah, I think it was, yeah, like 154, 156.
Okay.
Like I was taking this idea that, like, let's just get the thing converted. Like, let's move it along. All these are highly converted malts. Like, there's not a problem there, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I settled on 150, 152 only because I wasn't adding something that you would find in Pale 31, which is a carafoam or carapils type of malt. So this is just base malts. Like,
okay,
the simplest version of this then would be like 50% pils, 50% like Viramatua or Viking. I would sneak up to 15% Maris Otter in there just for fun to kind of give it an interesting, slight, more biscuit aspect to it. But that's the malt bill, and that's why one of the reasons why I'd go up to 150, 152
okay
as opposed to 145. However, that is an important variable. Lowering that down, making sure you get full conversion before you just kind of send starch over into your kettle is an important aspect of that. Something I didn't mention kind of when we were talking about troubleshooting up top.
Hmm.
I started looking for starch conversion in the mash before I would just continue on, right?
Okay.
So you homebrew long enough, you stop doing that. You're like, oh, I know my ingredients. I know my process. I don't need to check for that anymore.
Yeah.
I was concerned though that part of these diacetyl creep problems later were like, I'm leaving starch somehow in the finished beer. So valid question, valid point.
Okay.
And someone could attempt to control that by going even lower than that.
Okay.
But yeah, yeah, my target for this would be 150 to 152 ish kind of range. Pretty simple on the hop bittering side, just 0.7 ounces or about 16 IBU of Simcoe for 75 minutes. Mm-hmm. Didn't touch on this earlier, but I'm still a believer in adding a little bit of hops, not too much, on the hot side, and have them coagulate and boil for a while. I
definitely
think that helps with, for me, it was something pretty simple. Like, then I'm not fighting boil over while I'm cleaning other stuff and getting things ready. Adding a little bit of hops does that. If you're only targeting, in my mind, like 10, maybe 10 to 15 IBU, it's not going to change the beer too much. And actually, having a little bit of that isomerized hop component, I think adds to our impression of like a nice, crisp, clean type of finish. So targeting about 15 IBU for the really early hot side, like 60 to 75 minutes, and then leaving it really blank until the end and doing whirlpool hopping, that would give you maybe about 15 IBUs. In this case, I was using Strata, but I would substitute any of the hops I kind of mentioned earlier as the ones that would fit really well for West Coast America style pale ale, Simcoe, Citra, Mosaic, anything like this. And then doing, I have one of those Lickman hop backs. I like that thing quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So doing another 2-4 ounces in there of kind of a similar hop that you like before you're sending it over to some kind of a heat
single pass through it.
Yep. That kind of thing too. That's optional though. I wouldn't think that's essential to doing this, but it's kind of fun. 10 gallons batch split between White Labs WLP01 and then, like I mentioned up top, the Saf Ale dry yeast, the Fermentis US05, and fermenting those at starting at 63 and raising it up to 66. 1 degree each day until 68, and then holding it there for until 7 to 10 days. That's a point where I would start, especially when I was troubleshooting these diacetyl things, like check it at that point and see where I'm at and see if I'm having BDK or diacetyl type problems before dry hopping. And then the dry hopping range in that realm of like maybe 0.7, but more like 1 ounce to 1.5 ounces per gallon of a fresh hop that you like, maybe backing that down to like 0.5 or 0.7 ounces per gallon. If you have cryo would be one really good way to kind of fight this. Something like Simcoe Citra Mosaic cryo or a Simcoe Citra Mosaic pellet up to about a 1.5 ounces per gallon, and a shorter dry hop contact time, maybe about 7 days max, up to a lower temp, maybe as low as like 50 or lower. I didn't go lower than that. I know there are guys that certainly do these days. That was kind of my limit in terms of pushing the temp back down. But really being mindful of along the way of watching for terminal gravities and diacetyl before you start crashing it or doing lower temps and things along those lines.
And again, back to your best practices, maybe doing the water bath test on that diacetyl at that point.
Doing the water bath test on it and those sorts of things before you start moving into a phase where you don't want the yeast to be active anymore. You still could have precursor that could transform and all those kind of things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like a good pale ale to me. Ready to drink it.
I know.
We got wins pale ale in front of us at least. Though,
where
right?
do you
Which
think,
is awesome.
I wanted to ask you guys, I think it's always hard to predict ingredients. In fact, I learned from some BJCP judges, the good ones, you're not even supposed to really predict ingredients or sometimes processes when you're judging a beer. You can talk about what's wrong with it. You can talk about this or that, what's right about it. But to try to predict. Anyhow, that being said, I'm going to ask you to predict. What do you think about this malt bill? Like, do you think this is kind of the very new school malt bill? No crystal.
What do you think, Vito?
Yeah, definitely new school. There's no crystal malt in here. I'd say Pilsner is the base malt.
Probably.
Maybe even a 50-50.
Yeah.
Okay.
About Wynn being
super
a fan
clean,
of,
super, you know.
Of producing lots of German-style lagers. So, you know, they probably had some base malt-like pills around or certainly wasn't afraid to use it. That does seem present.
Do you think it's 100% pills? Or you think there's something else going on?
I think there's two. It seems like there's two row in it or something. Else that's possibly a wild card, but it seems like there's definitely a German style pills type malt in there if I had to guess. It might be all two row too though. It could be surprised, but it seems a little bit more the color alone.
It's very light straw.
Super light, and it seems to have a little bit of that sort of, you know, toastiness, just slight toastiness to it. Yeah. On the other hand, when we had row two Hill 56 earlier, that was a little bit more old school in the sense it's a great beer, awesome beer, and a great platform for Simcoe, but it's got a little bit bigger bitterness,
a
little bit more color. It's got a little bit more of a classic kind of older, a little bit older school pale ale.
It's kind of in the middle, I think. It's no Sierra Nevada. It's not that old school, but it's not this dry and new school either, right?
Exactly. It's very 2008, 2012 era, where it's got a little bit of in both camps.
Right. My two favorites on the market right now, no surprise, are still Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, always in my fridge.
Can't go wrong.
It's never too old school for me. There was a time on my palate that it was. That time is gone. It's never too old school for me. And Liquid Gravity's a Pale from the Crypt.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Beer. Oh,
and
yeah.
Again, that has some old school features, certainly the color. You know, he must be doing something. It's got a good meaty backbone, but so new school on the hops and dryness of it and everything else. Like it's a new school pale ale.
Yeah.
Not like Winds here, right? It's got a little more body than that, but that's great. That's my wheelhouse right now, actually, is like anything that's within a few notches either side of Pale from the Crypt, that's my real wheelhouse. And then my go-to is still just Sierra. Yeah.
And you can find Sierra everywhere too, which is awesome. And especially if you can find it in decent shape, then you're stoked.
Well, that's the other thing though. Like as you guys talked about earlier about the control, just their O2 control and their control of everything else. It's actually harder to find Sierra Nevada in bad shape than it is to find it in good shape.
If I'm on a road trip in the middle of nowhere and I got bad options at a gas station, I'm like, I'm going to probably grab Sierra Nevada Pale Ale more than anything else because there's better than average chance that's
100%.
Even if it was handled bad.
Exactly. It's,
And another pro tip, and I've given this pro tip plenty of times before, but if you're new, if you go to a dive bar and they have Sierra Nevada on tap, you know, I'm talking a dive bar here. I'm not talking like, you know, oh, it's kind of, I mean like a shitty bar. A lot of shitty bars now will have at least one good craft beer. If you see Sierra Nevada on tap, ask for it in a bottle.
Hmm.
They almost always also have in the bottle. And if you're at a dive bar, take the bottle.
Yeah.
It's not Sierra Nevada's fault.
No, their lines are bad. Yeah.
Take the bottle. That's my old school tip for you there, too, is if you have any doubt whatsoever of the quality of the establishment, take the bottle.
Unlike my bad keg conditioning experiment, that is actually a bottle conditioned beer in really good shape.
And it's probably been mostly refrigerated its whole life. It certainly was when Sierra had control of it. And if it spent some time unrefrigerated, their O2 levels are so low that you're probably going to be fine.
Yeah.
Penske
file from Faction.
Oh, that's a fantastic.
That's a really nice pale ale, and one that I think has been a product of lots of years of dialing in this idea.
Yeah.
And it's their, certainly Roger and all the Faction crew, their version of what their ideal pale ale is in many ways. And it's a little more crystal driven than what I talked about, and a little bit more along the lines of maybe what you'd find from Liquid Gravity.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit more in that realm.
It's within a couple notches right
there. Awesome beer, though.
If I'm going to order certainly a keg awesome for beer. Myself from here, it's actually, because I can't always get kegs of Pale for the Crypt, it's Penske file. That's what I take home.
Penske is fantastic. Yeah. It's slightly bigger. It's like 5.8, but it's got, I think it's one of the best Equinaut.
Yeah.
Beers that I think I've ever tasted, one that really showcases what that hop can bring to the, leave it as Mosaic or at least one of their hop in it. Anyways.
Trying to think of another widely available or nationally distributed pale ale that we could recommend, but I can't think of another nationally one. There's a few others that are widely available, at least on the West Coast.
Yeah, we're a bit spoiled because the region has so many too. But I mean, Sierra Nevada was a great one to point to. But
it is.
As a national one, but we can't say Pale 31 anymore, for example.
I know, like that would have been, exactly something that we, I used to love to 1500.
Oh, Drake's, yeah.
Yep.
I still like that from time to time. I don't love it as much as I used to, and I can't put my finger on why, but I do still like that beer.
Yeah, I'd love that one. Had it a couple months ago, though, and I was like, it wasn't.
I still enjoy it. I think that one, sadly, as
I think
much
it's
as
my
I,
memory of it.
As much as I love Drake's, the competition for taproom space and tap handle space in places is super high right now. I just see it around a little less. Whenever I do, I normally do have it and enjoy it. But a nice Simcoe Amarillo pale ale, if I remember correctly. Mm. A really nice one.
Yeah. In fact, you made a couple of 582, I think was one. I'm trying to remember some name. It's funny. If you go to Faction.
Shout out to Faction. They won a GABF award for 582 this year,
right.
Actually.
And that's a pale ale, right? That's a pale ale.
It's an awesome pale ale. It's featuring a very new school hop, a badass hop, about 582.
Yeah. It's funny that if you go to Faction, there's always like five pale ales on. There's partly because he always has a ton of beers on. He loves pale ales. And I think it's probably the only brewery I've ever been to that there's almost always five pale ales on. It's fantastic.
Roger's stuck in his ways, and there's no session IPA, or
there's no
variation on the IPA thing. It's like, this is a pale ale.
Yeah. You know?
And not only, full disclosure, Nicole does one of her part-time gigs is working at Faction, and I love those folks, and they're near and dear to me, certainly because of that, if nothing else. But of all these experiments that I did, one of the cool things was getting really, really good data. Mm. From time to time, because Nicole is doing lab work there, she would.
Oh yeah.
Let me slip in one of your things to.
Nice.
Just to see if we're out where we're at, sort of thing. Which
do
is
you
cool.
remember during COVID we did? It was the Fresh Hop thing. We all got together, like 10 breweries, and it was fun. Like Nicole took everybody's beers, came back and like analyzed them, and like
wow.
you're out 4 points on your alcohol level, or you know, it was just she was
oh,
like busting
cool.
people out. It was great, you know, it was hilarious. It was,
I bet the brewers actually loved that.
Oh, we loved it, man. Yeah. It was awesome. Yeah,
yeah, brewer, one of the toughest things, especially, I mean, homebrewing, it's insane. Like you don't have good data anywhere, and there's no really, really good ways to collect it. And on the pro brewing side, that's even more of an important thing because you got a business that depends on it. But being able to get good data out of a lab, you know,
yeah.
is always valuable, even if it's kind of in the moment sort of way like that. I think people do really appreciate it.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah,
lends credibility to your experiments here that you shared with everybody.
That's cool. So. You can get like let's say you have a data from something like an alkalizer. You not only have like your finishing alcohol quantity and your finishing gravity, but you know based on that what your starting gravity was.
Hmm.
So I can go back and say, and in many cases through experiments and the iterations that I was going through, I'm like, okay, my equipment's off by this.
Oh, right.
Right. And so I was oftentimes saying, thinking I was like at 9 Plato, I was really at like 9.5 or something. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So my gravities were starting a little bit higher than I thought. And on the attenuation side, I was attenuating a little even further than I thought in some cases. So then you take that into consideration when you're doing this. Like not everyone has access to try and get data like that, but those are really interesting in the moments where you do. I think like White Labs, for example, does they used to, and I think they maybe do this sometimes. They had like a what they called a big QC day.
Yeah,
I remember sending in samples for this many, many years ago. That's where cool. they do a nice discount for homebrewers who want to send in a sample. And I think back then they did like 2 or 3. They probably do something similar to
they do.
Still
yeah,
do that. And yeah, you pay some cash to them, and they will run your stuff, and you get cool data back. If you're
yeah.
serious about trying to, you know, go pro or at least get better on your homebrewing side, and you want to understand your process, those are pretty interesting things. As much as we like to trust our measurements, they're sometimes not right.
Sure. There's still $20 hydrometers, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where I was going to go. A lot of the manufacturers, like Anton Parr specifically, is making a homebrew level, you know, bringing, you know, so you don't have to spend $40,000. You know, they got stuff for like $400 that yeah. you know, is close.
Nice, yeah.
So you're starting to see that make its way to the homebrew level as well.
I love it. Well, gentlemen, Nate, Vito, thank you so much for coming in and doing this with me. This is super fun. I like to, I'm my goal for the show, for listeners and everybody, is to just to change it up. I don't always want it to just be prose. I love bringing back in homebrew, and the more that I can do that and try to change it up, that I'm really going to try to do that, because this is super fun for me. And I do feel like my interviews are a little different now. Like in the early days, I really just would have listened. Of course, I would have asked a dumb question or 10. But now I somewhere in the back of this weird brain, I have a bunch of data there that helps me listen to your data too and like compare it. And so it's a lot more fun for me right now. It used to be fun for me too to like not know anything. And then there was this like middle zone where I knew a bunch of stuff, even though I couldn't brew very good. And now I'm sort of back to like both. I like taking what I knew and now know. And like you said, there's all this new school stuff happening with new hops that it's a little more fun for me because I understand it in a different way. So I appreciate you guys.
You have all this natural instinct of what all this baseline knowledge now. You know?
Yeah, whereas when I started, I had no I think it was part of the success of the show. I had no baseline knowledge, and that helped all the beginners. Well, now I can't just fake that I know nothing anymore. I still know I would call it very little, but I know enough to like, I really can grasp what you're saying. And I'm drinking so much more new school beers. Like I've also gotten out of my rut of only drinking Sierra Nevada, right? It's just really fun for me to listen to this ingredient talk and this process talk, because I'm tasting this stuff out in the commercial world too. I'm tasting hop creep. You know, I'm tasting some of these things we're talking about.
Oh, it's out there too sometimes, and I think people got a good grasp on it though. But if you run into it, you'll know what it is, and it's sometimes it takes a few days for it to emerge. But
and just remember, don't shame your brewer for that per se in those hoppy beers. You asked for 5 pounds of hops per barrel, consumer. You fucking asked for this, and now they're having to deal with it.
Oh, and we love it, but it's fun stepping back through making these beers thinking I knew what I was doing, and I was like, uh-oh, wait a minute, I have a lot to learn here if I really want to make them good again, which is cool. Right. It's a never-ending journey because all the stuff changes. There's no way in which you think you could ever mastered it. So thanks, this has been awesome.
I hope you'll come back and do more of it.
Indeed.
You know, HomebrewCon this year is in San Diego, Nate.
It is. San Diego rules.
You have that on your radar at all?
It is on the radar, yeah. I think I need to go. I don't know.
You think you're going to brew for it?
You and I were just thinking.
We've been talking about it.
All right. You know, Chris Graham and I brewed last year, and I think we're going to do it again this year.
Oh, you should.
That was my first year ever entering the national competition.
Oh, damn. Nice.
And, you know, Chris and I made a couple mistakes that we're ready to fix, and I think we might be in it too. So, you know.
I might get over that. It was the year it was in Philly. I think that was 2012 or 14.
Yeah.
I entered like 15 beers that year, and none of them went to the
that was
next
your heartbreak
like,
year.
Oh, that was the jump the shark, time to hang it up sort of moment. But
yeah.
You persist, you know what I mean? I'd entered since and been back and whatnot. But and San Diego rules. Like, you can go there and just not even enter and enjoy the whole thing and just kick around and go enjoy awesome breweries in San Diego. Some of the best beer you'll find around. But I think it's time to go back.
I think so too.
I'll meet up there.
I think that's going to happen. All right, folks. Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to check out our sponsor, More Beer. They can do everything. Everything we talked about today, you can probably find over at morebeer.com. Also, don't forget to go get your Spring Brews Festival tickets. That's March 25th this year. It's Saturday from 12 to 4. Probably be about 60 amazing breweries there. There's a Facebook event for it over on the Brewing Network Facebook page. I'll start listing the brewers there next week. We're about third to halfway there with our brewers. So I want you to go check that out. Get your tickets. Come hang out with us. All right. And then keep on homebrewing. You know, it's not all about the pro beer. All right, folks. Thanks for hanging out with us. Take care of yourselves and your beer.
Session is a production of the Brewing Network and brought to you by More Beer. Check them out at morebeer.com. Find more content and live video of this show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brewingnetwork. For sponsorship opportunities and information, please reach out to advertising@thebrewingnetwork.com. To reach our hosts, contact feedback@thebrewingnetwork.com.